KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Hello, 50s.
This nation that's been so isolated can show the world the power of a new beginning.
My gender has never been a factor in accomplishing my unit's mission, and it should not be a factor when selecting personnel to serve in combat roles.
The first cost estimate that I have seen has suggested that this storm will cost the region $50 billion.
Myanmar, Burma, and its awakening, but the problems that are arising. We're going to take that up in in-depth conversation this hour. Also, we're going to talk to a captain in the Marine Reserves who wants to see the military lift its ban on women being assigned to combat roles. And we start with what's happening on the East Coast. You heard Governor Chris Christie talking about the estimate in the billions for recovery. You also heard that the impact from Hurricane Sandy has had a profound impact on the economy, slowing down consumer spending, slowing down projects, but in a perverse way, maybe some growth will come as rebuilding takes place. But how are people rebuilding and what is it like there now? We thought we would check in with Paul D'Ambrosia again, Director of News and Investigations with the Asbury Park Press. Asbury Park, city of Neptune, they're about 35, 40 miles south of New York on the Jersey Shore. Paul D'Ambrosia, thanks for talking to us again.
Thanks for having me. Good morning.
Good morning. Tell me, how about your personal situation? What's happening with your life in terms of the recovery?
Oh, well, thanks for asking. We're pretty much back to normal. We were more inland, so the wind knocked down one giant tree, and that's now firewood. So I'll suffer the winter and a few more winters with that. But overall, you know, personally, everything's been back to normal for us. I can't say that for a lot of other people on the coast. We still have 56,000 individuals who've been displaced by the storm.
Yeah, I saw on the headline this morning on the app.com, hotel rooms are still homes for thousands of people.
Yeah, that's a sad fact. And because the storm really hammered our barrier islands, a lot of people had to move further inland to find motels, and a lot of them are booked up. We have people in our area who had to travel probably 60, 70 miles south or further to find motel rooms down in the Cape May area, the southern part of the state, or as far west as Philadelphia and beyond.
Which has been the most surprising thing about the cleanup for you? I was looking at the fact that people are having to find places just to pile up all the debris and hope that somebody else, usually the municipalities, are going to haul it away.
Yeah, it's become an incredible burden here. The Army Corps of Engineers calculated it's about 500,000 cubic yards of debris. And to put that in perspective, if you put debris into those like standard size steel dumpsters you see in front of buildings, and you line them end to end, they would stretch from New York City to Cleveland. That's the amount of debris. And what we're doing now is there's still a tremendous amount of used furniture, drywall, broken boards, anything that's just got wet, put out on the curb up and down the barrier islands, and they're just coming by with front-end loaders, picking up, putting in their giant dump trucks, then take them to holding stations in the area, and then they eventually will transfer them to the landfills. Like here in Ocean County landfill has about another 25 years of life. By the time it's filled up with sandy debris, it'll take 1 year of life off of that landfill.
You know, when you look around at your community and you hear those reports about the impact on the economy of the whole country from Sandy, how do you see that translating into what people are choosing to do or able to do in their own communities? Are they buying? Are they holding off? From Lowe's, is Lowe's shopped out?
We're seeing, actually, we have with Black Friday, we had an above average turnout on Black Friday. So I think it's a mixture of people replacing items that they've lost or buying essentials that they need for their new temporary shelters, and people just feeling, you know, it's time to start giving more. And we've had an incredible outpouring of generosity from across the nation, people coming from all walks of life as far away as Texas and California to come here just to provide aid. We've had religious groups come in, and every little bit helps. And it's not just like huge jobs are doing. They're coming in and just helping with, you know, buckets and mops to help clean up flooded houses, and to people coming in and helping chop down trees and move stuff around. I mean, from my own situation, my parents live on a barrier island. And, you know, everyone we knew said, hey, you guys need any help to move anything, you know, that's washed up on your parents' property. We're here to help you. So it's just a tremendous outpouring of support that the area is really grateful for.
And how about in terms of power and in terms of ability to get around on the roads up and down the coast? How does that look today?
The major thoroughfares like the Garden State Parkway and the Turnpike, they're all passable. They're all perfectly in fine shape. All the trees that fell down on the parkway were cut up and moved like a day or two later. The local roads on the barrier island, some of them are still shut down. We had sinkholes in the Lavalette area and around Seaside Heights and Orley Beach. So they're in the process of repairing those. And the same way for some of the hard-hit areas, they're going to be a while before they come back. The power situation is pretty much back to normal, except for maybe a couple apartment buildings that just had some fires. It's a much more involved job to repair those type of situations. But the power for most people came back on, I would say, in about probably 5 days, and the last outage was turned back on like about 2 weeks later.
Wow. Well, people did have to deal with that for a while, didn't they? That must have been a shock to a lot of people. How long it took?
The real shock was is how much how weak the infrastructure is here. Once the power went out, everything else started collapsing. You know, we couldn't have food delivery, couldn't have food food stores, couldn't service anyone. Gasoline couldn't be pumped. So it was really our Achilles heel here when we had that kind of blow. And because of the outage was so long, it took really a Herculean effort by the government and the National Guard and FEMA to come in and just try to start restoring power as quickly as possible.
We talked to Paul D'Ambrosia, who's Director of News and Investigations with the Asbury Park Press, the South Jersey Shore. So what is the idea or the opinion among people living there about what kind of rebuilding should be done along the shoreline?
That's a pretty good debate that's just about starting about now. You have obviously prior property owners who own a lot of the property that was damaged or destroyed. The question is, if they want to rebuild, should they be able to rebuild in the same area, or they have to move back? If they move back, they can't, because then they're in their neighbor's front yard. So then the government would have to come in and set new standards. Should their house be higher? Should it be designed differently? Should the dunes be higher? All these things are going to be hashed out in the coming months, and there's real no clear pathway yet as to what's the best way to do it. I think what everyone agrees on is that our situation, we were not well protected in some areas because of the dune situation, and that's a priority that has to be addressed in the coming months to really pump those dunes back up and get it to a height where it can withstand even just a moderate storm that may come down in when we get to March northeasters.
And for Asbury Park Press going forward, which are the biggest stories? That one, obviously, that you're going to be covering.
We're going to be looking closely at the rebuilding effort and the political efforts behind this, and ultimately the money. The state has asked for $37 billion, and I believe that's going to grow as they get more and more information. This is probably going to be the most expensive storm ever. It's going to top $100 billion for the region, including New York State and other states. And that's a lot of money that has potential for fraud and waste. And, that's what we do as a newspaper. We kind of keep our eye out for it and act as a watchdog and see where it's going. And the other thing is we want to make sure this doesn't happen again. And we want to make sure that the policymakers and the politicians realize you can't just build again and hope for the best. You have to set some really strong standards for protecting the coast.
Well, Paul D'Ambrosia, I appreciate you taking the time again, and good luck. I hope we talk again.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Paul D'Ambrosia is Director of News and Investigations with the Asbury Park Press in the press this morning. One of the stories, checkbooks are opening. As of Tuesday afternoon, the Federal Emergency Management Agency dispersed $260.5 million to more than 234,000 applicants statewide in New Jersey. FEMA is on site trying to answer some of those questions that Paul D'Ambrosio was talking about. Roger Ferris, our home repair expert, you know, he's the Hazard Mitigation Community Outreach supervisor for FEMA, and they sent him to the East Coast where he's been working in Connecticut. Yes, Roger?
That's right. Steve, can you hear me all right?
We're pretty good. What are you on, a big cell phone, a big speakerphone somewhere?
Oh, it's enormous, yeah.
Well, that's what they got in the East Coast. Roger, we heard Paul D'Ambrosio say that the next thing to figure out is whether you can build the way they have been building on the coast. What are the questions that you're hearing in Connecticut, which I understand you say lots of devastation, just not as much news coverage?
That's true. Connecticut got hit hard. And this is one of these times when I feel very fortunate to be part of the hazard mitigation group that can do some really helpful things after a disaster like this. As you know, we try to help people look ahead and build back stronger and safer. And that's been our focus. And we've got our teams out doing just that. The response has been great. People really understand. You know, they were hit here about a year earlier by Hurricane Irene. It wasn't a hurricane when it came ashore, but it did a huge amount of damage. And this part of Connecticut, the coastal areas, regularly have these nor'easters, which we don't hear as much about. They don't make the news throughout the country, but they do a lot of damage as well. The storm surge and waves come up, and so they very much understand that building back in a different way to prevent future damage is absolutely crucial.
Well, describe what you've seen. Give me a couple of snapshots of the kind of devastation you've seen.
Well, it's the same as what you've seen in the photos of New York and New Jersey along the coastal areas. Houses that came off their foundations and were some of them totally destroyed. And then what you don't see and what doesn't make the news as much is that the inland houses that are back behind that front row are often a little bit lower, more modest. And they get water in them. And that water isn't so visible. If you get close, you see a water line, a kind of line of mud, maybe 2 or 3 feet up or more on the front door and along the siding. But, of course, that does tremendous damage to everything inside. And the cleanup from that is a real challenge. Now, our advisors who are out trying to help people cope with that give very good, very accurate advice about how to clean and sanitize properly so that they don't live with a health hazard.
Do you have people surprised at the amount of destruction that nature wrought? I mean, have you had people really overwrought about what they've encountered?
Well, people here are not all that surprised because they have seen it before. It was shocking to have it come again a year later. But and for some people, it was heartbreaking because they did just complete their cleanup from Irene, and then Sandy came in and did the same kind of damage. So that has sealed the message that adding elevation or relocating or taking some kind of action to prevent future damage is just crucial to a proper recovery and for what we call resilient communities.
Can you build resilient communities back where they have been, or should there be and will there be a push to not rebuild in certain areas?
That, of course, is a challenge for communities to sort out, and they're doing that. There are ways to build in hazardous locations. However, you know, with erosion, with beach erosion, it is tricky, and so you have to have very careful planning and very good engineering. Some people, though, have really created structures that stood up very well to the storm, and part of my job is to capture those stories and to share them. And in fact, that's one of my favorite parts of this job is writing up the best practices stories and getting them distributed. So we've got quite a few good examples of how to live with nature.
Give me one, Roger.
Sorry?
Give me one. Give me one good example. Give me one of your best practices you've encountered.
Some folks have rebuilt in the past using a very massive foundation system of poured, reinforced concrete piers that are tied into a very, very deep foundation system, goes way down into the sand, and reinforced with lots of steel, and they're way up off the ground. So the waves come up and wash right under those buildings without damaging the structure at all.
Wow. Is that overly expensive, or is that within the affordability for some of the little houses we saw get washed away?
The figures I've seen are that a very solid storm-resistant foundation system adds about 15% of to the cost of construction when it's a new construction. So it's very much affordable when it means that you save the whole building every time there's a storm.
So I know I asked this, but I just want to ask this again. Is there a place where you stand and you see where destroyed buildings are littered across the shoreline and you personally say, yeah, we can't go back there? Or is there always the possibility to rebuild structurally sound systems?
Well, I've seen next to those houses that are washed away, there typically are several that were built to the modern standard, and they did just fine. However, erosion is an issue, and so in some places the beach erosion is pretty severe, and that gives pause.
How long are you going to be there?
Not too much longer. I have some meetings to go to up in Maryland, and then hope to be home and see family.
All right. Well, we hope to see you again, too, Roger.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks a lot. Roger Ferris is in Connecticut. He's, as you heard, documenting best practices and trying to figure out what happened with those places that did get washed away or destroyed by the storm surge and the erosion following Hurricane Sandy. You're listening to Weekday on KUOW.
Coming up, we'll take a look at what the future may hold for the country of Myanmar as democracy takes hold for the first time in nearly 50 years. Stay tuned.
Support for KUOW comes from TIAA CREF, helping people pursue their financial goals. Learn more at tiaacref.org/WA.
When you consider your year-end charitable giving, please remember KUOW. Gifts of stock and appreciated assets are a great way to support KUOW and receive tax advantages at the same time. For more information, contact us at 206-221-2732 or email majorgifts@kuow.org.
It's 9:21. This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle. I'm Andy Hurst. We have clouds and rain, 51 degrees in the U District. We're expecting showers the rest of today, the high getting up to 55. Clouds and rain tonight, the low in the upper 40s. It's going to be cloudy, rainy, and windy through the weekend. Tomorrow's high in the low 50s.
Last year marked the end of the 49-year-old military regime in Myanmar. Those leaders like to call that country Myanmar. We also know it as Burma. After a general election, the junta stepped down in 2011, opening the doors for democracy in the Southeast Asian country. President Obama went there a few weeks ago to talk about the promise and the dangers of a company that's loosening its control of its citizens. As one of the poorest countries in the world with a horrendous human rights record and a deep-rooted military presence, it is having some growing pains. Mary Callahan is a Myanmar expert at the University of Washington's Jackson School of International Studies. She joins us again to talk about these issues. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
So the New York Times this morning had this article about the far west in Burma, where Buddhists and Muslims are at war, I should say. And the Buddhists, the powerful Buddhists, the more powerful ones, are saying to the Rohingya, is that how you say it?
That's Rohingya, yeah.
Rohingya Muslims, don't belong there, should be gone, shouldn't be killing animals and assault their senses and sensibilities. There's a battle going on, lots of displaced people. That's sort of the things we're going to be expecting to hear out of Burma now?
I think the Rohingya situation is really unique in the country. That part of Myanmar is...
Say that again.
Myanmar. Yes.
So not Myanmar.
No, not Myanmar, not as George Bush would say, Miramar.
Miramar.
The location where the Rohingyas live is interspersed among Buddhist Rakhine communities. Rakhine are another ethnic minority group in the country, but they are largely Buddhist. It is considered by many Buddhists throughout the country the front line, the sort of wall that held back the spread of Islam across Southeast Asia.
You mean over the last 800
Yes,
exactly.
Years. Wow. Exactly. And that's the narrative that is very prominent and popular across the country. You see monks demonstrating in places like Mandalay and Yangon, arguing for the Rohingyas to be pushed out of the country. The situation in that area for the last 30 years has been rife with problems, periodic crackdowns on the Rohingyas. They are considered not to be native to the country and therefore are not eligible for citizenship. And so periodically, the Ministry of Home Affairs and the Army has pushed them back across the border. It's a very fluid border, just a river, into Bangladesh. And then every time that happens, UN agencies and international organizations come in and help bring the Rohingyas back and settle them back in to northern Rakhine State and then take care of them.
Wow.
And taking care of them is a two-edged sword because the Rohingyas live essentially in concentration camps. The Myanmar government doesn't allow them freedom of movement because they're not citizens. UNHCR regularly posts appeals for millions of dollars to help them keep this very unpopular community alive. And that's all situated in a state, Rakhine State, where there's enormous poverty everywhere. And so the Rakhine Buddhists are wondering why the international community is so intent upon supporting the very difficult conditions that the Rohingyas live in, but they're not intent upon helping the poor people elsewhere in Rakhine.
So what does that situation tell us about overall about how Myanmar is going to proceed with incorporating its various ethnic communities into a democratic state?
That particular community is the biggest problem because it has no, under the 1982 citizenship law, it has absolutely no ability to make any claims for citizenship. Under the most recent constitution, 135 groups are recognized as native enough to qualify for citizenship. And at this point, the president and his chief advisors have indicated that they're open to a more federal kind of system, political solutions for incorporation down the road for everybody but the Rohingya at this point.
Really?
So
Even the people in the north where they've been fighting sort of a political
civil war
for a while?
Yeah, there's some quiet progress being made behind the scenes on that. So, you know, I think Myanmar at this point is undergoing three transitions. One is a transition to democracy. One is a transition to peace, and that involves incorporating the ethnic nationalities. And one is a transition to a modern economy. The transition to democracy will not help the Rohingyas. Anybody who comes out as being pro-Rohingya will never get elected in the 2015 elections. And so that's why you see Aung San Suu Kyi and other Democratic parties really equivocating on this question.
Yeah, that was one of the points that we've been reading is that Aung San Suu Kyi is, equivocated.
Yes, she's equivocated.
She wants to see her people in power.
I don't know that that's her calculation, but I also don't know how much she really knows about the political history. So.
Well, Ban Ki-moon, the UN Secretary General, he said that if violence between Buddhists and Rohingya Muslims continue, it could irreparably damage the country's social order. Do you agree with that?
I think it could. We're now in this strange situation where the Buddhist communities in Western Myanmar and the Muslim communities see only the army as a way of protecting themselves. And so both sides actually want the army to come in and keep peace for at least the interim. And that's unthinkable in recent history that any communities want the army to come in and establish law and order. And I think what Ban Ki-moon is getting at is that there are clauses in the Constitution that allow for the president, the National Defense and Security Council, to set aside the Constitution and invoke emergency rule. And so if the situation there gets out of hand, it's along a border with Bangladesh, and Myanmar and Bangladesh have significant tensions over trade, over commerce, over the law of the sea claims. It's a highly tense area. And so I think what Ban Ki-moon is getting at is it may be the pretext for greater army assertion of power.
Mary Callahan is a Myanmar expert at the University of Washington's Jackson School. By the way, she's giving a talk at the Seattle Asian Art Museum on this issue December 1st from in the morning, 9:30 to 11. Myanmar and its many peoples, prospects for continuing reform in Myanmar. When you look at the military today, how has it transitioned to this new government, and is it protecting democracy or something else?
The military is the one place where we really have very little information about what's going on. We know so much more than we've known for 50 years about what's going on in the top levels of the government. But the military remains quite opaque. So you have to do a little bit of criminology. You have to look for anecdotes and signs. There are some good signs. For example, the military the commander-in-chief just authorized very senior officials to take part in talks with some 22 American officials, including very senior generals from the U.S. Pacific Command, on human rights. This is sort of unthinkable. The military is undertaking to rewrite doctrine to be more in line with the new constitution and a more open kind of governance. And we've also seen things like military holding companies have been forced to restructure so that their money doesn't go into black boxes that are no longer on the budget.
One of the big complaints about how it was operating.
Yeah, exactly. And so there's anecdotal evidence that at least under this commander-in-chief, Min Aung Hlaing, the military is rethinking much of its internal workings, what it's going to take to get promoted, how it's going to operate when the peace deals are finally signed, where its garrisons are going to be, not be, that kind of thing. So there is a big internal set of internal processes going on.
There are still hundreds of political prisoners in captivity. Hundreds have been released. What's their state?
We don't really know how many political prisoners there are. It's a very imprecise science. And as you may know, Myanmar people do not have family names. And so a lot of the names on the lists are replications, or they're misspelled, or that kind of thing. The only way that you can calculate how many political prisoners are still in jail is by talking to those who just got out, because the political prisoners are kept in a different part of every single jail in the country for complicated historical reasons. And so when the political prisoners are released, they are immediately asked who's still left in the political prisoner wing. And a whole different set of names comes out, and it's very difficult to figure out exactly how many and who they are.
You know, I was just thinking, for you as a Myanmar scholar, is this like everything's cracked open?
Yeah.
All this exciting stuff is revealed?
Yeah, it is. And it's extremely gratifying. You know, I've probably made 30 trips there over the last 22 years, and it's very gratifying to me to see people who have been trying so hard in figuring out ways to do such good things for so long in civil society and in the media and education. And now it's all paying off, and many of them are in important positions right now.
What was the significance of President Obama's trip for those people and a stronger civil society in the future?
I think it's quite significant. you know, I get up in the middle of the night and I call friends because of the time zone difference. And there was a real sense of elation among many of them. You know, he came across as humble and respectful of Myanmar's history. He got most of the pronunciations right. And he also, I think people there generally recognized that he was taking a huge political risk by doing this. Political risk with, you know, congressional opponents of, you know, continued engagement. I will say, however, that ethnic nationalities felt, ethnic minorities felt like he underplayed the importance of their aspirations. And so it isn't a universal sense of everything's better, but I mean, just for example, one friend of mine who's a taxi driver said, you know, now when I try to go to Bangkok or, you know, Singapore or somewhere, I can go with dignity because my country is back in, you know, on the international stage. And President Obama has given us that kind of dignity.
Well, that's significant. What's the what are next steps? What should we watch for?
I think next steps over the next 3 years, the country faces all sorts of challenges, many of which have been written about elsewhere, macro, microeconomic challenges, challenges of ending the ethnic conflicts, et cetera. But I think each of the next 3 years has particular moments that will show us whether things are going to go well or not. 2013, the country is host to the Southeast Asia Games. It doesn't have the capacity at this point to do that. You're going to have people coming in from Philippines and Indonesia who are probably not going to be quiet about how difficult the conditions are. 2014, is the country is the chair of the Association for Southeast Asian Nations. It has to host about 1,200 meetings in 365 days. Again, there's no hotels for you or I to stay at in the country, much less all of those attending those meetings. And the country is undertaking its first census in 30 years. Huh. In 2014. And there's enormous fear on the part of the ethnic nationalities, ethnic minorities, that they will be undercounted and therefore will lose political representation. And then finally, 2015 is the next election. And that is what the United States is looking at as the benchmark. The United States, I think, expects to see Aung San Suu Kyi as president. And between now and then, the Constitution actually has to get amended in a way that lets her become president. And I'm not sure that that's politically feasible as yet. So there are enormous challenges over the next 3 years.
A lot of work for you to do. A lot of things for us to follow.
Yeah.
Mary Callahan is a Myanmar expert at the University of Washington Jackson School of International Studies. She's going to talk more about these issues at the Seattle Asian Art Museum December 1st, tomorrow, 9:30 to 11 a.m. And her talk is called Myanmar and Its Many People's Prospects for Continuing Reform in Myanmar. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
This is Weekday.
There's no such thing as a guy bombing his first time on The Tonight Show and then having a delightful career. You're gone.
This is Alec Baldwin, host of Here's the Thing. This week, David Letterman talks about how he and his show have changed over the past 30 years, and Michael Douglas on parenting, movie villains, and the fight of his life. Here's the Thing from WNYC and PRX. It's where I find out why people do what they do.
Here's the Thing makes its KUOW debut tonight at 7 o'clock.
Support for KUOW comes from HopeLink, each year working to help tens of thousands of people in the community with food, housing, transportation, and job services. More information this holiday season at hope-link.org. Lend a hoping hand.
We have clouds and showers, 51 degrees in the U District. We're expecting rain the rest of today, the high reaching 55. It's going to be cloudy and rainy tonight, the low in the upper 40s, cloudy, rainy, and breezy through the weekend. Tomorrow's high in the low 50s, Sunday's high in the upper 40s.
UOW comes from the Seattle Symphony, presenting the Wyckoff Masterworks Concert. Morlot conducts Mahler's Symphony No. 4 on November 29th and December 1st at Benaroya Hall. Tickets online at seattlesymphony.org.
A little more on that weather coming up with Nick Bond later in the hour, and we're going to review the news of the week next hour. Do stay with us. Right now, earlier this week, Marine Captain Zoe Bedell joined other members of the military and the ACLU in filing a federal lawsuit challenging the exclusion of combat roles for women serving in the military. The changing nature of war has put women on or near the front lines, but the law excludes them from formal combat training and military promotions. Marine Captain Bedell has been deployed to Afghanistan twice. In 2007, she was commissioned as an officer in the Corps, and last year she left active duty for the reserves because of the combat exclusion policy. Captain Bedell, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you for having me today.
Do I still call you that as a reservist?
You can call me Zoe or whatever is comfortable for you.
All right. Well, I appreciate you talking to us. What will you describe your deployments to Afghanistan? What did you do the first time?
Sure. On my first deployment, I was with a combat logistics battalion. So our battalion provided as part of that deployment, I was engagement team.
You know what, Captain Bedell? Guess what? Are you on a cell phone?
I am not. I'm on a landline.
Well, that's weird. Turn to your left or right and see if we get a better connection. Otherwise, we'll call you back.
Okay, I could give you another number if that would work better.
All right, hang on. We'll get Katie to get it for you. Hang on one second. This is our current reality. I apologize, folks. We're a live show, and so sometimes live shows just happen that way. I'll tell you what, you want to do this? You want it? All right, Andy, you take it. Do a little dance. Andy, that was a good dance. I like that dance from Andy Hurst. Captain Bedell, how's that?
I can hear you fine. Is
oh,
that better for
oh,
you?
That's so much better.
Oh, good.
All right. Okay.
Sorry about that.
No, it's the technology. All right. So again, what were you doing the first time you went to Afghanistan?
Yep. So I was in charge. I was with a combat logistics battalion. I was the current operations officer. So our unit provided logistics support to all of the infantry units operating in southern Helmand province in Afghanistan. And I was also involved with a program called the Female Engagement Team, where our mission was to go out and patrol around with the infantry and meet the Afghan people, and particularly the women, and learn about their concerns, learn about their problems, and learn what they knew about the community. And then on my second deployment, I was running the female engagement team full-time. So I took that experience from the first deployment and got to do it all the time, which was a great experience.
Can you give me one memory you have of being in with those female engagement teams and talking with Afghan women and where you were, how you were treated, and what you learned?
Yeah, sure. I mean, that is a huge question. But I have, on my second deployment as the leader of the program, I started engaging with the women who were elected to the Helmand Provincial Council. So that was pretty cool in Afghanistan because these were elected officials, and they were women. So, not hugely common. And we were talking to them about, what they wanted and what they were hoping to get out of this program. And they were talking about their frustrations about being treated as equals and their status in their society. And said that, they look at us and they look at the opportunities that we have as women. And they wonder why they can't have that themselves.
We're talking with Marine Captain Zoe Bedell, twice deployed to Afghanistan. Were you in combat situations?
I personally was not, but my Marines were on a very regular basis.
That was because there are no front lines in Afghanistan, as we understand.
No, Yep, that's exactly right. You know, basically, anytime anyone sets foot in Afghanistan or Iraq, they're on a combat zone. And some of your listeners may be familiar with the recent attack on Camp Bastion, which is a very big base. It's in the middle of the desert. It's sort of considered, you know, a logistics hub rather than a combat position. And it was recently attacked. They destroyed multiple fighter jets, and Marines lost their lives. So there really is no safe zone anytime you're serving in one of these conflicts.
Well, what would have been the difference for you if you had, if this lawsuit were to succeed and the exclusion of combat roles for women serving in the military was dropped? What would have been the difference for you in your service?
That's a huge question. It obviously involves a lot of hypotheticals, but there are some areas where it's a little bit more clear cut. When I was part of the female engagement team, one of the sort of things we had to do to comply with this policy was I would have to pull all of my Marines out of the field every 45 days for up to a week. So everyone was located with infantry units way out in sort of remote areas. It's not easy to move around in Afghanistan, especially longer distances like that. The units would have to transport my Marines back to a big enough base, and then they'd have to wait to get on a helicopter, and then it also, sometimes took 2 days. It was massively disruptive to operations and meant we weren't providing the support that we had been sent out there to provide. And there were even cases where commanders were rescheduling major operations so that they could wait to have the female engagement team back on the ground with them.
Do you want to see the idea of women serving in combat roles expanded beyond, for example, what you described, to allow women alongside men fighting in the same battles?
Yep, absolutely. I mean, so what's happening now is that they are out there fighting in the same battles. My Marines patrolled daily, sometimes twice a day, with these infantry units. And if they were attacked, my Marines were attacked too. There was no sort of waiting to determine the gender of the group out there. And my Marines fought back, and they performed admirably. So it already is happening, and I would like the policy to be eliminated to reflect the reality of what's going on the ground right now.
Do you have officers, male officers, who agree with you on that?
Certainly, yes. There are some who don't, absolutely. But I think, you know, people who have served with women and seen them out there know that they are performing these jobs they're performing these jobs to the same standards that the men would be expected to perform to.
What's the difference in your mind between women and men in combat?
I think my experience and the experience we're seeing across 10 years of war is that there isn't one. Assuming everyone has the same training and is prepared to be there, everyone responds exactly how they're trained to, and that's a testament to the professionalism of our armed forces today.
Well, what do you think of the arguments that you've heard them? Women are not physically strong enough for certain combat situations. If a male soldier dies, could they carry his body back, carry the equipment back? What do you say to that?
Sure, yeah, and strength is definitely an important aspect on the battlefield, but there are multiple characteristics that you would want of a combat leader or just a combat soldier. Ability to make quick decisions in high-pressure situations, ability to shoot straight, and I certainly would want everyone who's serving in those situations to be able to meet all of those requirements and be able to meet all of those standards, and right now, women don't even have a chance to compete to meet those standards. So that's what we're asking for. I'm certainly not asking anyone to lower standards, but I want there to be reasonable standards and that women be allowed to try to meet them.
Where would that be? In training or in combat situations as well? To meet those standards. To meet the standards. Where would that take place?
Well, so the way the military is set up is there's always lots of training and there's a lot of evaluation before anyone gets to a combat zone. So if someone were not able to do it, you know, there's a lot of opportunities to test them and screen them out if that would be the case.
Here's a Forbes commentator opposing this idea. He said, "This is no civil rights matter. Men and women are legally equal, but are not identical and never will be. Biological, psychological, and other innate differences between sexes are undeniable. Even if you believe nature authored these distinct attributes, there's no getting around them. Pretending otherwise does neither sex justice." You know, that's the argument you're going to hear. Women just don't belong there. I'm sure you must have heard that when you were trying to become a Marine in the first place, right?
Yep. No, and, you know, I think there's several different responses to that. First of all, women are already there. They are already doing these jobs, and they're performing admirably. So, you know, just sort of trying to pretend that it's not happening is not really a realistic situation. And again, certainly there are some women who can't do this, but there's also some men who can't do this. we're not trying to let everyone in. We're trying to make it an even field to compete so that the women who can do it have the opportunity to serve the same way that their male peers are. Because really, this is about choosing the best person for the job. Right now, commanders can only choose the best person if he happens to be a male. But there may be women who are better qualified to do jobs and who are going to be very good leaders. And we want to have the opportunity to put them on the battlefield because it's going to strengthen the military overall.
One of the other arguments, Captain Bedell, that you and others have made is that it closes off women from advancement in the Marine Corps and other places. What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you look at general positions, generals, I think 80% of those jobs are held by people who come from combat arms backgrounds. And those are backgrounds, those are jobs that are currently closed to women. So if women don't have a chance to even compete, they're sort of automatically going to be funneled out of those higher positions. And even within jobs that are currently open to women, if you are comparing people who have had the opportunity to serve either in combat units, which is closer to the core mission of these organizations of the military, versus people who haven't served in those units, that person who's had that combat experience or that combat unit experience is always going to be more competitive.
About 238,000 jobs are off limits to women in the Army and the Marine Corps. You're suing the Secretary of Defense, Leon Panetta, is one of the people named in the lawsuit. What do you want the military to do? What would it look like in terms of these restrictions on these jobs? Completely open? Removed completely?
Yes, so that's what we would like to see, is that this policy is removed completely. Now, there's obviously details behind that we think the DOD is best positioned to sort out, certainly. But the baseline is that this policy is unconstitutional and cannot be allowed to remain in place.
What's the status of the lawsuit? You filed it in U.S. District Court in San Francisco this week. What's the timeline as you understand it?
Yes, that's correct. It has been filed. Not being the lawyer myself, I don't know the exact timeline, but I do know that these things do not happen overnight. I certainly don't expect this to be wrapped up by Monday, that's for sure. but, you know, that's not necessarily bad. This is something that the DOD, I know, has already been considering. They're already looking at it. And this is just another pressure getting them to move in that direction. But still, you know, they have the time to make sure they do this correctly.
And what about for you? You left active duty for the reserves because of the combat exclusion policy. What's your future in the military?
Yes, that's true. I mean, when I was looking at my future, I was looking at the fact that I was going to be assigned to positions based on my gender rather than based on my qualifications or how I had performed in the past. And that didn't make a lot of sense for me professionally. So, and frankly, I don't think it makes a lot of sense for the military in the sense that, you know, they're just putting people into roles not based on who's best for the job. In terms of my service in the reserves, you know, the reserves are a very flexible organization. I'm not exactly sure how I will participate, if I'll be more active or not, but certainly I would like to see this policy removed so that all those opportunities are open.
Well, Captain Bedell, I appreciate you talking to us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me today.
Thank you. Marine Captain Zoe Bedell has joined other members of the military and the ACLU in filing a lawsuit in federal court challenging the exclusion of combat roles for women serving in the military. More than 150 women have died in the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, 950 injured, according to Defense Department figures. We're going to go back to Myanmar for the sound of the day. And now.
This is the sound of the week.
There are hundreds of temples and pagodas in Bagan, Myanmar. Onanda is one of the largest and most visited. Inside the tile floors are cool, and locals stop to pray there and leave offerings or light incense. And there's a school there as well. This is the sound of students and teachers chanting about Buddha being a holy man above all others. That's the rough translation our bicycling correspondent Willie Weir was able to get from a local. Willie Weir and Kat Mariner are bicycling around Southeast Asia in Myanmar. If you want to find out what they're doing, we have links, or you can go right to Yellow Tent Adventures. It's where they're posting all their stories about their adventures bicycling through that part of the country. And what about you? What sounds are you hearing? Record 30 seconds. Send it to us along with the story behind it. You don't have to go all the way to Southeast Asia. You probably have some good sounds right in your backyard. Email it to weekday@kuow.org with Sound of the Day in the subject line. Nick Bond joins us every Friday to give us a weather forecast, take a little bit look at the science and the policies behind weather. He's Washington State climatologist. He works at the Joint Institute for the Study of Atmosphere and Ocean. Hello, Nick.
Hi, good morning.
How are we doing for sunshine? Oh, look, there's a little sunshine right now.
Oh, yeah. It's not going to last long, though. There's some rain showers that are moving into the South Sound and just west of town, and they're knocking on the door.
Yeah, well, yeah. So more of the rain to come for the weekend?
Yeah, we'll have rain showers today and then turning to kind of steadier rain late afternoon, early evening. Lows only into the mid and upper 40s tonight, which is 5 or 10 degrees warmer than normal. So it's unfortunately kind of higher snow levels that we like. And then showers on Saturday and again a repeat with a more steady rain starting up sometime Saturday night, and more showers on Sunday and kind of a breezy weekend. So, yeah, rain's in the forecast.
You were looking at the kinds of days we got these past couple of weeks where the sun was shining and then the rains come. What's the specifics on that, cloudy versus clear days that occur in western Washington or Oregon?
Yeah, you know, we did have a couple of relatively cloud-free days earlier in the week, and it kind of spurred me to look and see if I was, you know, just what the stats are there and whether you need to keep your sunscreen handy and that sort of thing. And, of course, you don't. In Seattle this time of year, we only get something like 2 to 2.5 clear days per month on average. And that's a clear day is defined as something with less than 30% cloud cover on average over the course of the day. And we get something like 24 cloudy days per month. And so, admittedly, that sounds kind of gloomy, but it is even worse in some other locations in west of the Cascades. And in particular, in Olympia and Eugene, they only get something like a day and a half of clear days per month with that 30% definition. And they get more thick fogs.
Boy, I remember that from going to school in Eugene. Eugene was a much drearier place than here. Isn't it because we have a little more of the onshore flow coming from the ocean? What's it called, onshore or offshore flow?
Yeah, I think in these kind of interior valleys, especially like the Willamette, you just get a little bit more stagnant conditions than you do right around Puget Sound or even at the coast. And something that might be kind of surprising is that while it obviously rains considerably more on the coast, there are actually slightly fewer cloudy days at places like Forks and Astoria and a few more clear days than there are in the kind of interior locations.
Well, so I should just head down to the southwest, head to Yuma or Phoenix this time of year, right?
Yeah, and, you know, as far as I'm concerned, all Arizona has going for it is the Grand Canyon, good Mexican food. But if you really need the sun, yeah, Phoenix, more than half the days are clear, and it's cloudy only maybe 7 days a month. And Yuma, it's even, you know, sunnier. But don't blame me if your skin resembles that of a lizard when you get back.
Those are the trade-offs people make when they live in the Southwest. All right, Nick. All right, any chance? I like asking this around now. Any chance we're going to see snow around Christmas in the lowlands?
Yeah, it's far too early to say anything about that. So, one of our computer models has hinted at a colder pattern coming up way out in the future in kind of fantasy land, a week and a half, 2 weeks. I don't put too much stock into those kinds of projections. One thing, next week we are going to have a bit of heavier rains, it looks like, Tuesday into Wednesday. And at one point, it looked like there might be getting into a kind of a flooding scenario. Now it looks like it's not going to rain as hard or last as long, and it's going to cool off enough to get some snow in the mountains. But we have to get through that first, and then after that, basically all bets are off.
But the slightly warmer temperatures mean we won't get that a big big snowfalls over in the mountains this weekend?
Well, not until Sunday. On Saturday, the snow level will be flirting around Stevens Pass. On Sunday, it's going to come down to something like 3,000 feet in Snoqualmie Pass, and that's where we like it. We want, you know, snow at the ski areas and build up our snowpack and all that. But for the next couple of days, anyway, it's a little bit on the warm side, and so while we've received plenty of precipitation in the mountains, our snowpack is running a little bit below normal, and so we'd like to see that build up.
All right, Nick, we'll talk to you again. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Nick Bond, Washington State climatologist, joins us to give us some weather and some facts behind the weather. We're going to review the news of the week coming up with our news panelist. I hope you'll stay with us. You're listening to 94.9 KUOW Seattle. I'm Steve Scherr. We call this show Weekday.
Good morning. It's a minute before 10. Headlines from NPR News are coming up next.
Support for KUOW comes from Aegis Living, a senior living company specializing in assisted living and memory care.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.